I am here with Neil Ferguson. Neil, thanks for joining me.
It is a pleasure to be back with you, Sam. It's been too long.
Yeah. And it has not been boring, as we were just remarking on. It's an immense pleasure to be able to reach out to you at a moment like this, because there's just so much going on. And this is obviously your wheelhouse as a historian as a commentator on current events. We're going to do this. There's just so much to talk about. And I know you have a hard out here because you're going to a talk. So I'm going to be more operational than is normal. How has the first month of Trump's second term struck you thus far?
I think it's a bit like being in 1933, but I don't mean in Germany in 1933. I mean in the United States in 1933, because there hasn't been a presidency that has started with this much of a bang since Franklin Roosevelt's first term. The difference is, it's like the New Deal with the sign reversed. You've got this frenetic activity, executive orders coming at us like bullets out of a gun. And that was very much the pattern with the beginning of Roosevelt's presidency. There was also a barrage of legislation, which we're not yet seeing, because Trump does not have the great majorities that Roosevelt had in the Senate and House. But in terms of activity, it's comparable. Roosevelt still holds the record for number of executive orders per year of any president. Trump could beat it at this rate. But the signs reverse, because the goal of the New Deal in 1933 was to expand the federal government substantially as you came out of a depression, the worst economic shock in American history. The goal of Trump 2.0 is to shrink the federal government as you come out of the post-COVID boom. So it's a kind of New Deal, but with the sign reversed. That's how I think about it. And so far, I think that's been a good framework. There are other analogies, but that's the one that strikes me as most relevant to the first month.
And how do you think the last month and a half has seemed to our allies and our adversaries on the world stage? I mean, you can take it in whatever order you want, but in particular, with respect to adversaries, I'm thinking about Russia and China. I'm wondering how you think they view this barrage of change.
I asked a quite large audience in London earlier this week if anybody could say confidently that they understood the foreign policy of the Trump administration, and not a single person raised their hand. It was a quite international group. But I think if I had asked the same question in Berlin, I'd have got a similar response. In Paris, a similar response. People are baffled. They're bewildered. And at times I have been too. I was certainly pretty baffled last week when President Trump called Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, a dictator, suggested he had a 4% approval rating, suggested that Ukraine had started the war that began 3 years ago. That was pretty bewildering to me. Up until that point, I thought that there was a rational strategy to end the war. I've felt for some time that it's not in Ukraine's interests for this war to be prolonged. I felt that, in fact, in 2022. And I thought the rational strategy, which had been articulated by a number of people in the administration, including Vice President Vance, was to apply pressure, economic and potentially military pressure, to Russia to get to a deal. The Ukrainians had more or less acknowledged that they would not get their territory back in the short run, but that they would accept that if there were security guarantees. The outlines of some kind of armistice, at least, were apparent. And I couldn't understand why Trump suddenly rounded on Zelensky and appeared to concede to President Putin of Russia many of the things that the Russians probably hoped they would get at the end of a protracted negotiation, such as no NATO membership for Ukraine. So that was a little bewildering. I think my role as an historian is twofold. First of all, it's to try to put this in some kind of broader perspective, using analogies to help us get a better sense of where we are. The other role is to be humble. You can't do history in real time and always be right. And some of the things that are especially difficult about this moment will not prove to be right or wrong for years. But let me try to make sense of what we're seeing. And also to answer the specific question you asked, how do they see this in Moscow? How do they see it in Beijing? I think in Moscow, they're feeling good, but not completely relaxed, because they have, to some extent, handed the initiative to the President of the United States. And that means that, to some extent, their fate is no longer in their hands. In Beijing, they're doubtless looking on with some amusement at the divisions that have opened up between the United States and Europe. But from the point of view of Beijing, this is not the main event. Ukraine is not the main event, and nor is the Middle East. The main event is Taiwan and more broadly, the South China Sea. From the point of view of America's European allies, the bewilderment has rapidly turned into resolve. And let me try this thought out on you. Presidents since Richard Nixon, so for 50 years, have been trying to get the Europeans to pay a greater share of the cost of their insecurity without success. The Europeans have consistently allowed the United States to bear the lion's share of the costs of NATO. But Donald Trump appears to have achieved what eluded successive presidents since Nixon, namely, the Europeans in the last few days finally realized that they do in fact have to take responsibility for their insecurity. And the days of free riding and allowing the United States to provide their security are over. So if you wanted to try to rationalize what just happened by saying such outrageous things about Ukraine, Trump has succeeded in making the Europeans realize that the post-1945 international order is over, and they will now have to stop talking about strategic autonomy and actually doing it. And the sign of how successful Trump has been was what Friedrich Merz, the Christian Democratic leader in Germany, said just after winning Sunday's election, which was, in effect, I now understand that the US backstop for European security is over, and we are going to have to get serious about increasing our defense spending and taking care of our own security. So that's probably the single most important thing that's happened in the last week. The Europeans have been talking endlessly about strategic autonomy for years. I've heard so many European leaders give speeches about it. I remember just a few years ago, Bruno Le Maire, French minister, gave a speech I was present at, in which he said, Europe is a superpower and it will have strategic autonomy. And the audience clapped enthusiastically. He got the biggest round of applause for an entire conference. And it was all completely empty words. None of it happened. The European defense budgets barely moved. In the case of the Italian budget, didn't move at all. Now, the Europeans have finally got the message. They didn't get it in the first Trump term. They thought Joe Biden would save them. And now there's no longer any more delusion possible. They have to deliver strategic autonomy, and fast, if they're to be secure from a fascist regime in Moscow.
Well, it seems to me strange if the only way to get the Europeans to not free ride and take their investment in hard power seriously would be the moral collapse of the United States on the world stage. I mean, it's to rewind to the deranging moment you just referenced with Trump blaming Ukraine for the start of the war and claiming that Zelensky is a dictator. It's not only upside down, it's obscene to characterize what has happened these last 3 years in that way. I mean, Putin has not only launched a war of aggression against Ukraine and killed who knows how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people there, stolen tens of thousands of children to Russia and repatriated them. He's all but threatened the U.S. with nuclear annihilation for our support of Ukraine, right? I mean, certainly his proxies have on state television. There's been widespread torture of Ukrainian POWs. I mean, he's not a normal actor on the world stage. And yet we have an American president not only failing to criticize him as a dictator, but criticizing his victim as a dictator, putting the moral onus of all of this chaos and destruction on the victim. I mean, it's just, it's so disgraceful just as an American citizen to see what should have been the moral and effective leadership of our country and what would have been, you could imagine under almost any other president, to see that vacated so fully. I get that there's, you know, the one possible silver lining to it is that it has so terrified our allies that they now are going to take more responsibility for their own safety and security than they have in the past. But surely there was another path to that outcome.
Well, Churchill used to say that the United States would do the right thing when all the alternatives had been exhausted. And I think successive presidents have tried just about everything else to get the Europeans to pay their share. So one begins to ask after 50 years, what else could possibly have worked? Mm-hmm. But let me suggest another way that we might understand this moment. You've made some moral remarks there and used the word disgraceful. From a realist perspective, which Vice President Vance certainly says he represents, none of that matters. You're just engaged in liberal histrionics. In the world of great power politics, you can't be motivated by those moral considerations because what matters is national interest and power.
But don't alliances matter? I mean, isn't much of our power historically the result of being a shining city on a hill to aspiring democracies and being a reliable friend to our allies? And now we're some kind of shining sewer, you know, on X with a...
Shatter your illusion, Sam, but not many people outside the United States have believed that stuff about a shining city on a hill for a very long time. I wrote a book called Colossus back in 2003, which had as its subtitle in the original hardback edition, The Price of America's Empire. And that was a book that was highly skeptical about the neoconservative enterprise that we embarked on after 9/11 to try to transform politically Afghanistan and Iraq and what was called for a time the Greater Middle East. I think one has to look at American foreign policy in its historical context with a little bit more of a hard stare rather than through rose-tinted spectacles. The back and forth between idealism and realism is in some ways a preoccupation of journalists and academics. Mm-hmm. In reality, administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, have tended to be quite ruthless in their treatment of both allies and adversaries. There's an old Henry Kissinger joke about only one thing being worse than being America's foe, and that's being America's ally.
Right.
The South Vietnamese can tell you a thing or two about how it goes when the United States backs a country. Not always well. So I think we need to be a little bit skeptical about the idea that suddenly the United States is betraying its legacy as a shining city on a hill. That's not the history of American foreign policy, as anybody outside the United States thinks about it. But let me suggest this. One way of thinking about the Trump administration is that it is not only realist in an academic sense, but in a very practical sense, that at least some elements within the administration have a very clear understanding of the limits of American power. You said American power has to do with alliances. No, it doesn't. That's peripheral to American power. American power has to do with the incredible strength of the U.S. economy, which has consistently been the largest economy in the world since World War II. It has to do with American technological leadership, and it has to do with the American ability to project military power, hard power, all around the world. That's what really matters. And that is no longer an uncontested dominance in the way that it used to be. I don't want to bore you with statistics, but let me give you just one. In 2001, which was the year China entered the World Trade Organization, American manufacturing value added was more than twice that of China. Today, China's is more than twice that of the United States. There has been a huge reversal of economic fortune. China's economy on a purchasing power parity basis, adjusting for differences in relative prices, has been larger than the U.S. economy for at least 8 years. And so we inhabit a world in which the United States' dominance can no longer be taken for granted. In a sense, Trump has more in common with Richard Nixon than most people realize. I've been joking in recent conversations that Trump is Nixon's revenge, both domestically and in foreign policy terms. And Richard Nixon, when he came into the White House in 1969, had a very keen sense of the weakness of the American position. And his realism was actuated by that sense of American vulnerability. I think the same is true of Trump. Here's the thing that fools people. Trump talks a big game. He talks the monarchical imperial talk. But I think what actuates that, what motivates that very aggressive treatment of minor powers, hey, we want Greenland. Canada, you're going to be the 51st state. Panama, we want the canal back. What motivates that kind of behavior is a sense that in terms of geopolitics, relative to the superpower on the other side of the world, America's position is highly vulnerable. I would go further. The preoccupations with Ukraine and the Middle East, with Eastern Europe and the Middle East, the efforts to support Ukraine and Israel, are in the eyes of a completely unflinchingly ruthless realist, distractions and drains of resources, given the stakes in the Far East, in the Indo-Pacific region. To give you a contingency, an example, if the Chinese decided today to start requiring all ships going in and out of Taipei to clear People's Republic customs, what would the United States do? If they went a step further and imposed a quarantine, which would be kind of blockade light, what would we do? The reality is that the United States has very few good options if Taiwan's autonomy is going to be contested by China, because China has established meaningful military superiority in that theater. So I would suggest that one way of coming at the Trump administration is that, unlike back in 2017, when the challenge was to persuade Americans that there really was a Chinese threat, that was, I think, the main significance of the first Trump term, that was done and a bipartisan consensus emerged that China really was a problem and maybe we should even be in a Cold War with China. Now the problem is adjusting for the fact that China's in a position of real strength, and that could put us in a very weak position if Xi Jinping decides to call our bluff.
Well, everything you just said suggests to me that the importance of allies has almost never been greater, right? I mean, so when you say that Trump talks a big game and is bellicose in a way that people like myself find agitating, for the most part, all of that bellicosity is directed, again, at our friends or our erstwhile friends, right? So what my concern is that the people who should be standing shoulder to shoulder alongside us in any hot conflict or nearly hot conflict with Russia or China are now thinking that we have some kind of maniac in charge who's decided, as is almost his first act of his new presidency, to effectively attack Canada and Denmark and Mexico, right? I mean, like, and he, again, he says nothing. I mean, he doesn't talk a big game against our actual adversaries. I mean, he says, he doesn't say a bad word about Qatar, that, you know, that funds terrorism and harbors Hamas, et cetera, and has given tens of billions of dollars to American universities to spread their delusional anti-Western propaganda. I mean, this is all, like, if you wanted to dig into a defense of the West and a defense of the liberal democratic order, and what actual realism could look like in a sustained conflict with the enemies of that order, it seems to me we need to get, I mean, again, coming back to what you briefly mentioned, you know, J.D. Vance's remarks at Munich, right? I mean, you know, a wake-up call to the West, right, is perhaps needed. But it seems to me that Trump and Vance are doing their best to fracture any kind of Western alliance against its adversaries.
Let me take you back 4 years. Time travel is what historians do, but this is a short journey. And let's remind ourselves of the things that were said in the first 100 days of Joe Biden's administration. The adults were in the room. Alliances mattered again.
Some were so adult that they were clearly no longer compos mentis.
A little however, yeah. Over-adult.
Yeah.
And that was the line that the Europeans took and many commentators in the United States took. It was also going to be a transformative presidency. You may remember this from people like Michael Beschloss, that was going to be up there with Roosevelt and Johnson. And all of this struck me at the time as completely absurd. And sure enough, my prediction 4 years ago that this the Biden administration would be like the Carter administration, but with dementia, turned out to be about right. Because what happened was they made a big inflation mistake by throwing a ton of money at the economy, which she didn't really need to do because the pandemic was basically over. And they then did a series of things that completely antagonized the allies that were so happy to see them. They pulled the plug on the US and allied presence in Afghanistan without really telling any of the NATO partners what they were doing. They did it in the most chaotic way possible. That sent a signal that was picked up loud and clear in Moscow and Beijing. In 2021, they wholly failed to deter Putin from preparing an invasion, even when Putin signaled what he was going to do in July of that year, publishing an article on the historic unity of the Russian and Ukrainian peoples, which was a declaration of intent to do Anschluss. And they proceeded to do exactly the same in the following 2 years with respect to the Middle East, which they thought they'd somehow pacified on the very eve of the October 7th, 2023 massacre. So the Biden administration, which I think broadly agreed with your terms of reference, allies matter, all that kind of stuff, were a disaster. It was a succession of failures of deterrence that produced two major wars that the United States seemed incapable of doing anything to stop. That's an important setting for Trump 2.0. The real failure of whatever was left of liberal internationalism, the Obama foreign policy in its Biden-Harris incarnation, did create an opportunity for the new sheriff to say, you know what? The allies are weak and suck, and the bad guys are strong. We need to be careful. We certainly, I think this is, here I'm going to paraphrase what I think the Trump inner circle thinks. We do not want to be simultaneously in a fight with Russia, Iran, China, and North Korea. And I think that's interesting because there are some people inside the administration who think we should be. Here's the central rift that I see within this nascent administration. Many of the people who've been appointed to key jobs, including Marco Rubio, Mike Waltz, a bunch of people who are going to DOD, bunch of people on the National Security Council, think that there is an axis of authoritarians. China leads it. Russia's number two. Iran is number three. And Little Rocket Man is number four. And we have to deal with this axis because if we don't deal with it effectively, we end up rerunning the 1930s. I think there are plenty of people in the administration, as well as in Congress, who would agree with what I just said. But what's interesting is that the president's inner circle, which includes people who don't have formal jobs, like Tucker Carlson, take a completely different view, namely that the axis is too powerful. It would be much better to at least conciliate the key members. And Trump himself, even before he was inaugurated, was sending signals, particularly to China, that he intended to pursue détente. He invited Xi Jinping to come to the inauguration. He says he wants to go to Beijing himself and do a deal of some kind. We don't know what. So Trump, although he has quite a hawkish national security team, himself, I think, inclines towards détente, to use a word that has not been used for a while. Détente, particularly with China, but also with Russia. And he certainly wants to end these wars. And I think the motivation is not to shock and appall liberal Americans. The basic objective is to reduce American military commitments because they seem too great. Can we talk about Ferguson's Law, Sam?
Yeah. Yeah.
Ferguson's Law, named not after me, but after Adam Ferguson, the great Enlightenment Scot, one of the great thinkers, not as famous as the other Adam Smith, but should be, argued back in the 1760s that public debt, though a very attractive device, was ultimately a source of weakness if it got too large. And I tried to formulate this more tightly in a piece that just appeared last weekend. And the argument, it was in the Wall Street Journal, the argument was, if a great power is spending more on interest payments on its debt than on defense, it won't be a great power for much longer. And I tried to show that this has been true all the way back to 16th century Habsburg Spain, one of the first great European empires. It was true also of the Dutch Republic, of 18th century France. It was true of 19th century Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. It was true of Austria-Hungary, and it was true of Britain in the 20th century. And now it's true of the United States. 2024, last year, was the first year since 1934 that the United States has spent more money on interest payments on the federal debt than on defense. And I think that constraint looms very large in the minds of at least some people in the administration. Which is why, for example, last week we had reports of Defense Secretary Hegseth talking about cutting at least part of the defense budget or shrinking at least part of it. Trump himself talking about reducing defense spending mutually, the United States, Russia, and China, a language quite different from the language of the first Trump administration, which criticized the Democrats for not spending enough on defense. We've really got a different set of priorities here. Because the world has changed, and at least some people in this administration think it has changed in ways that put the United States in a much weaker position than most people realize it's in. So that, I think, is how to frame this. That the behavior that seems so outrageous to you, obscene, I think you called it, is part of a realpolitik motivated by a sense of the limits of American power and the need to avoid a showdown in three places at once, because the U.S. military cannot simultaneously contend with conflicts in the Middle East, in Eastern Europe, and in the Far East. That's clear.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's so many sides to this object that I'd like to touch. Well, we'll take the people who are in Trump's inner circle, right? I mean, who seem to have his view of the situation as opposed to the traditional neocon, or what is left of the vapors of neoconservatism, perhaps in the head only of Marco Rubio. I mean, it seems to me that he has appointed, I don't even know if this is debatable, he's appointed loyalists above all, right? And people whose CVs don't really shriek their qualifications for the various posts to which they've been assigned. So you have people like Tulsi Gabbard, and Pete Hegseth, and Kash Patel, and this is a kind of a rogues gallery of the unqualified, the compromised, the flagrantly conflicted. I mean, I don't know if you we could drill down on any one of these. I think concerns about Tulsi Gabbard as some kind of counterintelligence threat don't seem completely paranoid to me, if you know, based on incompetence alone. But this is like the RFK Jr.-ification of our entire government on some level, which is to say you point some ideologue who seems to have nothing but contempt for the part of government he or she is now overseeing in the role of authority there, and see what happens. Granted, the story up to the moment has been of the rampages of Elon Musk and Doge and the gaggle of teenagers and young software engineers he has helping him in that task. But all of this just strikes me as so chaotic, so unvetted. It seems to present the greatest espionage opportunity for our enemies to be seen in perhaps several generations. There's something so reckless about all of this. And again, the messaging about it publicly is in many cases just patently insane. It's a tissue of lies and active trolling, and it's so unprofessional. And so, I mean, again, you can hear my level of allergy to all of this. Again, these are my liberal norms being traduced on an hourly basis. But I find it hard to believe that it's just mere idealism on my part that is causing me to whinge to this degree. I think that being this cynical and transactional and so in the grip of people who obviously are just not, are more I mean, again, you know, our president's main qualification for the job, has, apart from his prior presidency, is that he was a game show host who convinced everyone that he was really a billionaire. And now he's managed to become a billionaire on the basis of that in some strange way. I just think we pay a price for this on the world stage. And everything you've said suggests to me that we can't go it alone, but we wouldn't have to go it alone if we recognize that Europe, you know, our EU partners, our EU allies, I think have, what, tenfold the resources that Russia has? I mean, the EU is a colossus compared to Russia in real terms. Russia has just proven that it can't quite defeat Ukraine as a conventional army, to everyone's astonishment. A war that everyone thought was going to be won in days or weeks has dragged on for years because of Russia's incompetence.
Well, let me stop you, because we've now reached the point where I've got about three or four different things to address. I think when one's assessing an administration, one has to look at the whole thing. And while I personally wouldn't have appointed Tulsi Gabbard to that position, if one looks at the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, you're dealing with some extremely smart and experienced men whose knowledge of markets is pretty hard to beat. That's going to matter, because this administration is bound to hit some significant macro and markets bumps this year. So I think we have to just be careful about cherry picking which officials enrage us. An administration's a big thing. By the way, most people haven't yet been put in the offices that they'll eventually hold, because many haven't even been nominated, far less confirmed. So we're talking about an administration at a very formative stage. We also know from history that sometimes people who attract a lot of media coverage don't matter terribly much. And it's not clear to me that RFK, for example, was a hugely important appointment. I think there was a deal done in the election that had to have some payoff. But I would bet that Jay Bhattacharya will be a more influential figure on public health policy than RFK. We'll see. But let's keep our minds attuned to the fact that the federal government is a very big thing that we spend a lot of time putting together after election. Second point, if you think this is a golden opportunity for espionage by our adversaries, can I introduce you to the Biden-Harris administration, where the Chinese undertook massively successful hacks of our infrastructure, with, as far as I can see, no adverse consequences? So I think we need to be clear-eyed here. There was no great golden age between 2021 and 2024 when it came to American counter-espionage. On the contrary, there were some really major disasters. They didn't get massive coverage, but then the media was notably relaxed about its coverage of the Biden-Harris administration's many lapses. So that brings us to the final issue that you raised there, which is, how does this work if we antagonize our allies and partners? You didn't mention, but you could have, the tariffs that Trump is imposing on friend and foe alike. Now, I think the way to think about this is in two steps. One, what are the alternatives these allies have open to them? It's not as if they have better offers in Europe from Vladimir Putin or a more attractive world order on offer from Xi Jinping. So, terrible truth is that the United States can be an abusive spouse in its alliance relationships with not much downside, not much risk of defection. The second point is to remember, it's a dynamic system and other players have agency. The big problem for Donald Trump is going to be the unintended consequences of his own actions. I think if you add together the tariffs, which are in the end just a really big tax that falls either on importing companies or on consumers, and on top of that, the I think likely fiscal contraction that's implicit in DOGE and other things that the administration's doing, and the drastic reduction in illegal immigration, which was a source of cheap labor for the US economy, I don't think Stevie Cohen is crazy to say that a slowdown is highly probable. So I think we are moving towards a quite different economic atmosphere this year. And that's going to be the moment at which people notice that the king of Mar-a-Lago is not all powerful, because the markets will react to all the things that I've just described. Second point, others have agency. Denmark doesn't have much. If Trump wants to beat up on the Danes over Greenland, they don't have a lot of leverage. But the Chinese have agency. And I urge your listeners and viewers to watch very carefully what is going on in the Indo-Pacific region right now. Just in the last few days, the Chinese conducted exercises off the coast of Australia without any warning that were designed to be provocative. The Taiwanese also took custody of a Chinese vessel that was engaged in cutting fiber optic cables into Taiwan. Stuff is happening. And Xi Jinping has the option to cause a Taiwan crisis at any moment. Mm-hmm. The problem with the Taiwan crisis is, unlike Cuba in 1962, an economy notable for its exports of sugar and cigars, Taiwan today, as you know, Sam, exports about 98% of the most sophisticated semiconductors made on Earth. And they are where Jensen Huang at NVIDIA gets his chips made. So a crisis over Taiwan is potentially a hugely disruptive event. And the U.S. doesn't have great options.
How long would it take to onshore that supply chain? And why haven't we started that process?
Yeah, we started. I mean, there are TSMC fabs in Arizona, but they are just a beginning. To replicate the full panoply of TSMC's production capacity on Taiwan in the United States is the work of many years. Mm-hmm. And one reason
in
that
Japan as well, right?
Some progress being made in Japan. But the truth is that this is a multi-year project. Even if TSMC were hugely into it, which they're not really.
Right.
But even if they really wanted to do this, it's not something that can happen remotely quickly enough. Because if you think back a couple of years when Bill Burns was running CIA, he said on a couple of occasions, our intelligence is that Xi Jinping has told his military to be ready for war in 2027. That's 2 years out. I think that might turn out to be wrong, because I think the perfect opportunity for this Taiwan crisis is sooner than that. It's about now.
Mm.
And so we have to watch very carefully. This, I think, is the thing that people miss. For the United States, foreign policy is a global problem. You don't get to just focus on one thing. You have to remember that there's just one global chessboard. And because we have put, you know, non-trivial amounts of firepower, of money, but more importantly, of material into Ukraine, and we've also given quite a lot of military support to Israel since October 7th, it didn't get much coverage, but the US really played a pretty important part, particularly in defending Israel against Iran. We have a limited amount of, particularly the high-quality precision missiles that are central to the American way of war. So if you look at the most recent war games that have been in the public domain, most of them come to the conclusion that the United States would run out of long-range precision missiles in a week in the event of a conventional war with China. So most people who think about this for a living realize that the United States really can't risk a conventional war with China if such a contingency were to arise. That's not a great place to be in if you are the dominant power in the world. You're at risk of being challenged if the Chinese leadership is willing to take that risk. Now, it's important to remember that this would be like the Cuban Missile crisis in reverse, because in 62, the island was off the US coast, and when we discovered that the Soviets were putting missiles there, we blockaded it, And then the Soviets had to send a naval force to run the blockade. That was how we nearly had World War III.
Mm-hmm.
In this scenario, the roles are reversed. The island is off China's coast, and the Chinese can impose a blockade. They could call it a quarantine, and then we would have to send the naval force. This is the thing that Admiral Sampaparo has to think about every day. What does he do? He's the commander of Indo-Pacific Command. What does he do if the Chinese make a move against Taiwan? And the answer at the moment is Hellscape, which is the name of the operation mm-hmm. that he's come up with to deter the Chinese. That's to turn the Taiwan Strait into a hellscape with drones, sea drones, air drones, submarine drones. The problem about doing that, even if we have the capability to do it this year, which I'm not sure I think we have, that would rapidly escalate into a large-scale conflict with the other superpower. I don't blame Donald Trump if he worries about that. If he worries about that, he's right to worry, because it would be very dangerous indeed. And the one thing about Trump that has always impressed me is that he's not a war president. He's a trade war president. Mm. He's much more comfortable with tariffs than with tanks, or for that matter, aircraft carriers. So I think the really critical thing to bear in mind here is that the US is fiscally more overstretched than at any point in its history. In terms of its manufacturing capability, it has clearly been surpassed by China. And it does not have the military industrial complex that it had back in the 60s that permits it to contemplate crises simultaneously in Europe, the Middle East, and the Far East. We're a much less powerful America than we were when you and I were just born. Yeah. That's the reality.
Yeah. Again, that keeps, not to be riding a single hobby horse here, but that does impress upon me yet again the importance of the entire free world being on the same page, if such a thing were possible. I mean, doesn't China import basically 80% of what it needs to survive, just in terms of its, you know, agricultural space? And I mean, like, if people ceased their dependence on China as a manufacturer of cheap supply chain goods, if we decided to boycott China, we being, you know, the entire free world, right? I mean, wouldn't China's vulnerability be something that could be impressed upon it rather quickly?
China's vulnerable to some extent to economic warfare, but much less vulnerable than it used to be. I mean, the theory behind American war planning 10 years ago was that the Strait of Malacca was the critical choke point, and if you could stop that, stop goods flowing through the Strait of Malacca to China, you could effectively cut China off from raw materials, including food. It's much less true now. Because mm-hmm. we've given the Chinese, and it must be said also their allies, a lot of time to think about how to sanctions-proof their economies. So China's trade over land is much greater than it used to be. Russia's now, it's one of its biggest trading partners. And so we're much less able to play the Malacca card than was true 10 years ago. In any case, I come back to my earlier point. What's the alternative for the Europeans, for the Japanese, for the South Koreans? If not the United States, then they would have to accept a Chinese-dominated world in which the surveillance system of the CCP would be extended generally, and the beneficiaries would be the bad actors who currently have good relations with Beijing. So I don't think America's traditional allies have an awful lot of choice.
You don't think we're paying an abusive price, relationship. But I mean, again, I take your point that they don't have a lot of choice, but insofar as they can just, you know, watch our misadventures and not, you know, stand shoulder to shoulder with us when that becomes costly, it seems to me that they're more likely to do that when they're in dialogue with, when they know themselves to be in dialogue, not with the Henry Kissingers and the James Bakers of the world, but with the Curtis Yarvins and the Tucker Carlsons of the world, right? I mean, there's like a lack of seriousness and competence on some level lurking in the background here. You know, I understand that there are.
Well, I think the competence question is a really interesting one, because I think there's been a steady erosion of competence in the federal government in every domain, and it can be traced back over decades. I think that's clear. It would be a mistake to say it just happened on January the 20th. One of the most striking things that I've been writing about for decades now is this meaningful and measurable decline in competence, whether it's in fiscal policy or in our military endeavors or in our public health. We look back, and perhaps we don't look back enough, on 2020, and the obvious conclusion is that the American public health bureaucracy completely failed in its response to COVID. And we haven't even bothered to do a post-mortem on that epic fail. Phil Zelikow had to do it privately because Congress wasn't willing to let him do another 9/11 commission about COVID. So there's a problem of competence, no question, but that's part of the American weakness I'm talking about. You can't, and I think this was what J.D. Vance was saying in my altercation with him last week, you can't act like it's 1990 when it's 2025. I think that's a fair point. We need to acknowledge that our power is considerably shriveled up. And I don't just mean power in the broad sense. I mean in our ability to execute. What was the lesson of the global war on terror? Think about it. I don't think we can look back and say that it was an unqualified success.
No.
Striking thing is how little was achieved in all of that enormous effort. So part of the backlash against neoconservatism, which Trump represents, makes a good deal of sense. Although they call just about anybody a neoconservative. I don't think Mike Pompeo is a neoconservative, but at the moment, if you're out of favor, you're a neocon.
Yeah.
Can I ask a slightly different question? It's the question I posed to myself at the beginning of last year. At the beginning of every year, I kind of sit down and I try to think about what the question of the year is. And I keep my notes around a kind of central hypothesis. The question of last year for me was empire or republic. That seemed to me, at some super simplified level, what last year's political contest was about. In that, if you believed that Trump posed a threat to the republic, which for a time the Biden campaign was trying to argue, then you had to vote for the Democratic candidate, whoever that was, no matter how senile or incompetent. If you believe that the Democrats pose a threat to American power, fundamental, potentially fatal threat, then you had to vote for Trump. That was kind of how American voters were placed. I think the most interesting question about this moment is how far the imperial impulse, or perhaps I'll call it the imperial tendency, is just unstoppably working itself out the way it kind of always does for republics sooner or later. As an historian who has spent much too long reading about the past, I can't get away from one of the central lessons of ancient, early modern, and Enlightenment historiography, which was republics always fail because they either tip over into a kind of democratic anarchy, or they tip over into tyranny, and sometimes they do one and then the other, which was Tocqueville's point about France. And Tocqueville thought the United States was different from France and wouldn't succumb to that tendency. But I think if Tocqueville came back today and took a look around the United States, he would see all the pathologies of Ancien Régime France. He would see a very centralized system of government, which wasn't true of the US when Tocqueville visited it. He would see an intellectual class that was highly irresponsible and divorced from reality. I'll take you to any of our major universities and introduce you to those people. And he might ask, if he looked at American society today, at what point did the French take over this country and turn it into a French-style republic? So the question that I'm haunted by is this late republic America? Is this just the late republican phase when we can no longer manage the institutions of republican governments? And is Trump the Octavian Augustus figure Because remember, nobody in Rome knew when the Republic ended and the Empire began. It was an imperceptible process. Nobody woke up, went down to the Forum and said, today Augustus is emperor. That never happened.
Mm.
So I worry a little bit, and I feel one should worry about this, that we are in the late Republic and the imperial temptation is now fully in view, openly in view. Now, it may be, and I think this way, maybe 2 or 3 days a week, that the Constitution is the most robust document of Republican government ever devised. And the founders were so aware of this danger, so conscious of the danger of a tyrant, that they designed it to be kind of tyrant-proof. And we'll be fine. But then, you know, that's why I said one has to have humility. One can't know. The historical moment feels like the late Republic. We just don't know if the Constitution can withstand this test. I hope it can. I think if it can't, I'll have to rethink my future plans.
Mm.
Because if it can't withstand these stresses, then it will become courageous to have an argument with the vice president. I've been really struck, Sam, by how many people have written to me in the last week saying how courageous it was of me to have a public argument with the vice president.
That's mortifying to hear.
I kind of laughed. It's like, it would be courageous if I was having a public argument with Putin, I was a Russian professor, or if I was having a public argument with Xi Jinping and I was a Chinese professor, but I'm an American having an argument with the vice president. I think it's kind of great that he's willing to have a public argument about this and go back and forth with little me. So I don't know why anybody thinks that is courageous. Maybe I'm the stupid one and I should be much more cautious, but caution has never been my strong suit.
Well, I think that it's perceived as courageous because people perceive the constitutional guardrails and the rule of law to be unraveling, right? I mean, they see Trump, again, hiring loyalists, you know, someone like Kash Patel, who before his confirmation said he was going to effectively destroy the FBI and turn it into a museum of wokeness or something. And I mean, we have Trump firing the inspectors general. I think he's fired 18 at this point, and unraveling any mechanism that would ensure against just patent self-dealing and corruption on his part. I mean, he launches a meme coin in advance of his inauguration. This is a mechanism by which people can just pay him and directly enrich him, whether they be foreign actors or not. But he seems to be unraveling more that is meant to guard against foreign powers just cutting checks to the Trump administration or to Trump companies as a way of influencing the Trump administration.
Well, I'm not the one to bring up Hunter Biden's laptop, but it would all be much easier to push back against if the Biden administration had not so completely betrayed its liberal principles.
Yeah.
I mean, the lawfare against Trump, the politicization of the justice system, and then the extraordinary let me finish, Sam.
Okay.
I think the tragic nature of the situation is that those who cast themselves as the upholders of the liberal order, both domestically and internationally, did a terrible job. And that's why he got reelected.
Yeah.
So, well, I fully agree. I mean, the temptation to honestly throw the stones only in one direction here. There's been a lot of playing fast and loose with the law, and there's been corruption, and it wasn't all on one side.
Well, that's true. I mean, I can certainly sign on the dotted line you gave me with respect to Biden's foreign policy failures. I think, you know, he will be famous for the degree in which he failed on that front. And yes, I'll accept some of the lawfare, although some of the suits against Trump, I think, were probably legitimate. I think the documents case was legitimate.
Absolutely. Some, but and not all.
But it's the change in optics is undeniable, as witnessed by the fact that people think you're putting your life in your hands by arguing against the vice president of the United States. I mean, people perceive my fighting with Elon Musk publicly as a security threat to me personally, right? Which is insane in a country like ours.
It is. I mean, and I don't think, I mean, the way I think about this is that we've created such a toxic public space, and it's been getting worse for years now, that anybody who takes public positions that are controversial is at risk, because the lunatics with the firearms are not a trivial number of people.
Mm.
That's the kind of threat that anybody takes who enters the public domain. I know this better than most because my wife has been in this situation for many years. She spoke out against the Islamists in the wake of 9/11, and we've dealt with the security issue ever since then. Now what people are gradually realizing is that political violence has spread out from the Islamists and the other habitual terrorists, and it's now just becoming a little bit more widespread, so that there are people making threats on the radical left who previously wouldn't have taken to homicide. We saw that in the case of the United Healthcare chief executive. So the problem in the US is not that there is a secret police and a dictator issuing the death sentences. The problem is that in this very toxic atmosphere of debate, when you're going back and forth on X, you don't quite know what lunatic is going to be triggered by what you've written. And that's one of the reasons way back in 2011, I decided to do more of my work outside the public sphere, was the realization that it was becoming so dangerous that if one were full-time in the public sphere, that would really elevate the risk to an unacceptable level. I wrote a book, The Square and the Tower, to try and just understand why we got to this place. And that came out, I think, in 2017. The thing I learned about doing that was that because of the way in which the network platforms evolved and so quickly centralized the World Wide Web, with algorithms that were designed above all else to monetize content, we created this extraordinary engine, or these extraordinary engines of polarization. And those engines are extraordinarily powerful, and nobody knows how to turn them off. In fact, you can't turn them off. They're too addictive to turn off. So I'm struck by the fact that all of the conversation that we're having takes place in the context of a public sphere that looks to be outraged, where there are people looking to be outraged by something you say or I say, so that they can turn it into a meme or a short video clip and get more and more eyeballs to connect with it. That didn't exist before. The public sphere wasn't like that before. And that's why what we do has become maybe it is courageous. We just don't realize the risks that we're running.
Well, not to outdo you in the cynicism department, but I think it's undeniable that people like Trump and people like Elon, I mean, those two people in particular, know when they put a private citizen on blast on social media, they know the risk that they're imposing on that person. They know that that person is going to get doxxed. They know that that person is going to get death threats. There's just too much water under the bridge for them not to know it.
Be fair, at this point, they've both taken enormous risks themselves. And I think that one has to acknowledge that it was nearly a fatal enterprise to run for a re-election for Trump.
Yeah.
That in putting himself on stages in Pennsylvania in the later stages of the campaign, Elon was taking a risk himself. So I think that's important to say, because one shouldn't underestimate their courage. I think it's important to acknowledge that. What I do is a lot lower stakes than that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's a fair amount of mania filling those sails beyond just courage. I mean, the idea that what is animating, if you look at the pattern of his tweets, the idea that what is animating Elon now is just a great sense of civic responsibility and, compassion for all the people who are suffering under fiscal mismanagement of the U.S.
I'm more sympathetic to him than you. I've known him for quite a long time. I think he's one of the truly titanic figures of our age, whose appetite for risk never ceases to astonish me. Otherwise, there wouldn't be Tesla and there wouldn't be SpaceX and I wouldn't have Starlink. I think one has to ask, what exactly should one make of a figure so colossal in his ambitions?
But it's not the ambitions, Neil, it's not the ambitions that I take issue with. It's the lack of ethical integrity. It's the lying. It's the amplification of anti-Semites and racists and, you know, pornographers of hate. I'm both a student of this and a target of this in Elon's case and a former friend of his. But if it were just carelessness on his part, if it was just too much ketamine and too many long hours in all of his companies, you would expect the errors to go in both directions. But he never accidentally amplifies the opinions of some woke maniac on the left. He's always accidentally, if it is an accident, amplifying a right-wing troll, a hater of Jews, a Nazi adjacent person in the fever dream of QAnon or Trumpistan, and the errors are always going in that direction. And so it is with all these guys. It's not just Musk, although I would say he's the main offender now. It's that they're always these right-leaning, far-right enabling amplifications. And this takes me to something I do want to ask you about, which is...
Well, can I just intervene? Yeah, just
please, go for it.
I think it's important to say it. I mean, I think part of what's going on here is a kind of unimaginably demanding level of multitasking that then leads to put it mildly, insufficient due diligence on certain things. In my mind, the alternative for Deutschland is a highly suspect organization with elements that aren't anti-Semitic, that have roots back in Germany's dark past. And it's bizarre to want to see them politically empowered in Germany when there's a perfectly decent Christian Democratic Conservative Party there. But what I think has gone on since he took over Twitter is a deliberate corrective, because prior to that moment, the left entirely dominated the network platforms to the point that they engaged in censorship of anybody who dissented from a whole series of progressive nostrums. So part of what I think is going on there is a conscious countervailing strategy, given that overall, on the eve of his purchase of Twitter, the network platforms aggressively leant left and did the opposite of amplify anybody who was seen as being on the right. In fact, would quite deliberately make sure that they had minimal exposure. That's all we should say on the subject.
Mm. Okay, so, but to follow in that vein, perhaps we can use Vance's remarks in Munich as a starting point. What was your reaction to that speech? I know there was a bit of a contretemps with him afterwards, but...
The contretemps wasn't about that speech. I agreed with most of it.
Yeah.
I didn't agree with the implicit argument that the AfD should be in power in Germany, or at least in the room. But I actually agreed with most of what he said. I think, and I can speak with some authority on this as a student of German history and of European history, I think there has been a kind of absurd deviation from liberal principles on issues of free speech, not only in the European Union, perhaps most egregiously in the United Kingdom. Yeah. It is genuinely surreal to me.
Summarize that. I think people will not even believe some of the examples that you might trot out because they sound so insane. But what is happening to free speech in the UK?
I mean, I think JD didn't even pick the craziest examples. In Britain, there is now such a thing as a non-crime hate incident, which George Orwell must be wishing he'd thought of, which allows the police, if you've put something in your social media that someone doesn't like the look of, to come and knock on your door and make intimidating inquiries and perhaps even take you down to the station, the police station. Anybody who expressed the view that the killer of the little girls in Merseyside in Southport back in the summer of last year might be a Muslim or an asylum seeker was liable to arrest, even although it turned out, but the British government hushed this up, that the killer was the son of immigrants who had become a radical Islamist, who in preparing for his massacre had Al-Qaeda training materials in his possession.
Yeah.
So we simultaneously censored the truth about what had happened and arrested people, put them on trial, and in some cases jailed them for things that they said on social media. So the world has in many ways turned a little upside down when it comes to free speech in Britain. And it's shocking to me. I wouldn't be surprised, Sam, if this government, Sir Keir Starmer's government, attempted to put an anti-blasphemy statute on the books, because there is significant pressure on them from Muslim members of parliament and Muslim organizations to do that. If that happens, I'm not clear that my wife and I can remain in the United Kingdom, because where we spend a good deal of time for family reasons, because that would put her at least, and possibly me too, in some danger. So I thought what Vance said at Munich was mostly right. And the only thing I felt like qualifying was that the United States has not exactly got a stellar record on free speech over the last few years. It's only since January the 20th, since the vibe shift was formally inaugurated, that there's a real pushback against the kind of cancel culture that I've had to deal with in American universities, and you certainly have encountered. But I liked the speech. That wasn't why he and I had a falling out. We had a falling out because I criticized Trump's comments on Ukraine and used the word appeasement to characterize what seemed to be going on with respect to Russia in the negotiations that were just beginning in Saudi Arabia. And I also said, if you think back to how we dealt with Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, I quoted George H.W. Bush, this will not stand. We seem to have become a lot less committed to preserving the sovereignty of states in the face of an aggressive invader than we used to be. That was what made him mad and led him to call me a globalist, I think. But I think that debate was a debate worth having for reasons that I alluded to earlier. I think it's true that we're not the United States of 1990-91, and we don't have the will or the capability to do what we did to liberate Kuwait. That's the harsh reality that I think lies behind the braggadocio of Trump 2.0.
Mm-hmm. Well, to linger on this point of free speech and empowering the far right and the problem of immigration and the problem of Islam or Islamism and jihadism, however euphemistically that may strike the ears of some listeners, there's kind of this nexus here that you and I have been students of, however unhappily for now decades, your wife to a degree that's been excruciating, your wife Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who, as many people know, is a friend and should be understood to be a feminist icon the world over, but is frequently derided by, as you go further left on the political spectrum, you meet people who are more and more reliably confused about her ethical stature, and it will strain your sanity to hear her attacked as a bigot and an Islamophobe and even as a racist by white girls on university campuses. I've witnessed that myself. So it's an amazing failure. From my point of view, it's an amazing failure to thread a needle that can be rather easily thread. If we think that the only way to deal with the threat of Islamism and the chaotic status quo of having indefensible borders, which obviously we should be defended, the only way to do that is to somehow tip over into a far-right populist kind of moral panic in Europe or in America or both. It seems to me that you can keep in view the derangement of the far left, the woke madhouse that has been made of organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center. You can see the moral confusion that erupted worldwide in response to October 7th, all the people who couldn't figure out that Hamas were the bad guys, on October 8th, even at the best universities in Europe and America. You can see how pathological all that is without becoming a Nazi or giving comfort to Nazis. And yet I'm seeing signs that we might fail to manage that. How does Europe in particular, I guess you can add America to this, but how does Europe in particular avoid tipping further rightward in response to the problems of immigration and the response to the looming threat of spreading Islamism that failures of assimilation are almost synonymous with?
It's very difficult to see how one avoids that rightward shift, because if one looks at the population of the world, it's declining in most places. We are heading towards peak humanity because total fertility rates have fallen below replacement most everywhere except sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
And that means that the societies of the Western world, in Europe, North America, are aging, and immigration is the way in which they've tried to offset that process over the last several decades. And we've seen surges of immigration in recent years in the United States because, for reasons best known to themselves, the Biden-Harris administration threw open the southern border. And in the UK, because for reasons best known to themselves, the Conservatives, in the wake of the Brexit referendum, actually increased substantially net migration from countries outside the European Union. So it's particularly tricky when it's Conservatives who've allowed immigration to surge to tell people, no, don't go near the far right. You know, the moderate right has kind of made it very difficult for that argument to land. And the same is true in many European countries where the perception is that the center right just blew this. That, I think, is the single most straightforward explanation for the emergence of far-right populist parties, whether it's Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, or you name any of the other populist leaders you like. The demographics are such that Africans are likely to continue to want to get out of Africa. And there's not going to be an economic miracle in sub-Saharan Africa. If anything, rather the opposite, if you believe even a fraction of the climate change doom scenarios. So the problem ain't going to go away. And the only consolation I can offer is that there are some moderate conservative governments who are doing quite well at this. In Greece, for example, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, who's a center-right conservative politician, has simultaneously turned the Greek economy around, improved the fiscal position dramatically so that in some ways it looks much stronger than the average European country, whereas it used to be the proverbial basket case, and has had a very tough immigration policy restricting illegal access to Greek islands and the mainland. So it can be done, but it's difficult, and it's not going to get any easier. I think in the United States, the picture's slightly different, because firstly, the Trump coalition successfully extended support outside the white working class core. That was one of the striking features of the last election. Yep. There's a substantial non-white support for a tougher immigration policy. And at least some elements of the Trump coalition favor increased legal immigration, hence the H-1B visa debate just a few weeks ago that it seems like months ago in Trump time. I think the US is likely to arrive at a somewhat different outcome from Europe, partly because it's easier for the US to police its borders, and partly because there is an obvious strategy to increase legal immigration. The demand for visas is enormous in the world. The US can meet that demand. Of course, President Trump wants to sell American green cards to the highest bidding oligarch, but that in a way exemplifies his openness to increased legal immigration. But yeah, I think your central point, Sam, that it will be hard to keep people away from radical right or far right parties is right. And that's partly because the center right parties have failed. And it's partly because of what we were discussing earlier. There's a lot of forbidden fruit out there. Part of the appeal of someone like Curtis Yarvin is that he says things that you wouldn't dare say on Name a Campus. And the forbidden fruit elements of what is going on the kind of red-pilled based techno right is interesting to me, because that explains part of its appeal to young men who, you know, who probably started out listening to us but realized that we weren't the hard stuff.
Mm.
We were cider or lager, and what they really wanted was Scotch on the rocks.
Yeah, well, we might yet surprise them. Who knows what blasphemies we're capable of. What do you think of Trump's plan for Gaza?
Part of Trump's art of the deal, and the book is well worth reading for this kind of insight, is in the beginning of any negotiation, stake out an absurdly extreme position, and then the counterparties will regard the final point of settlement as a great improvement. So,
except we have to acknowledge in those negotiations where you just give your adversary exactly what he was going to ask for without him having to ask, as seemed to have happened with the Taliban in Afghanistan, and it seems to be happening with Putin.
This is why he's hard to read, because some of the deal making is real and some of it's a kind of kabuki, a kind of entertainment. The Chinese trade negotiations in the first term did not produce a great outcome, and I suspect the same will be true this term. But if one looks at Gaza, I think radical solutions like we'll turn it into the Riviera of the Middle East and simply relocate the population are designed just to move the Overton window so that whatever you end up with seems to the Palestinians at least better than full-scale ethnic cleansing. I mean, I think the Middle East is important in this discussion. We haven't talked about it enough.
No.
The Biden administration's Middle East policy was an unmitigated disaster. Trying to restart the dead Iran nuclear deal only emboldened the Islamic Republic and led, I think, inevitably to October 7th. The Biden administration's first term was a real success story with respect to the Middle East. The Abraham Accords were a major breakthrough after decades.
You said the Biden administration's first term. You meant Trump's.
No, I meant the Biden administration's policies in the Middle East were disastrous. Trump's first term was extraordinarily successful.
Yeah.
And against the expectations of all the experts who derided Jared Kushner when he talks about what became the Abraham Accords. So I think one can be somewhat more bullish about the Trump administration 2.0, because I think the region's ready to resume the Abraham Accords process. I think there's also a kind of impatience with the Palestinians, and particularly with Hamas, and the Iranian position is so much weaker now. So, you know, while we've obviously got an audience that wants to hear us hate on Trump, we have to acknowledge how successful Trump was in the Middle East, how badly the Biden administration did in the same region. And that the prospects are quite good now. I think at some point, fairly soon, the Israeli government will take military action against Iran's nuclear sites, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be odd if they didn't, given that they'll never get such a good opportunity as they now have with Iran's air defenses, more or less, kaput. And the Iranian regime looks very vulnerable. They have no succession plan. Supreme Leader Khamenei is teetering on the brink of shuffling off this mortal coil. The Assad regime's gone, which greatly weakens the Russians' ability to make mischief. It's amazing. I mean, one has to hand it to Bibi Netanyahu, somebody that the world loves to hate, but he's actually been strategically tremendously effective in recovering from the catastrophic blow of October 7th, 2023.
Mm. Do you think the U.S. will or should or must join Israel in any regime change effort in Iran?
I think the support the U.S. gives Israel is most effective when it's least visible.
Mm.
I mean, if you think about the events after October 7th, 2023, there was substantial U.S. support for Israel initially when Biden sent two aircraft carrier groups. More importantly, when the Iranians made the terrible mistake from their vantage point of attacking Israel directly from the air. And I'm pretty confident that U.S. support was a large part of the reason that those attacks failed utterly. I think there was also considerable U.S. support for Israel's attack on Iran. So I think the Iranians can make it look, the Israelis, excuse me, can make it look as if it's all their own work. But in practice, it won't be.
Right. All right, Neil, I know you're getting to the end of your hour here, and I'm going to get you to your talk on time. So I'm going to pepper you with a few questions. Let's close the loop on Ukraine and Russia. Do you think the Baltic states are now vulnerable? I mean, when you imagine whatever, how the coming negotiations might bring the war to an end, does this leave the Baltics vulnerable? Do you think, do you follow Jeffrey Sachs in imagining that Putin has no designs on anything beyond what he currently has in Ukraine?
Well, Jeffrey Sachs is
tongue in cheek.
Crossed the line, yeah. Jumped the shark.
He ate the shark and crossed the line.
Yeah. Lost his mind, I think, actually, on this issue. But let's draw a veil over him. Mm. I was sitting with Gabrielis Landsbergis, former Lithuanian foreign minister, in Vilnius last year, talking about just this. They certainly feel vulnerable. If Ukraine has a bad peace imposed on it, that is to say partition, plus insufficient security guarantees, leaving it vulnerable to the fate of South Vietnam, then there is no question that Lithuania would have reason to fear. And I'll give you this as a succinct answer. This is why Britain and the European Union are now going to move frantically to try to build their own military capabilities back up, mm-hmm. because they know that looking out over 5 years or even 10 years, the Russian threat is not going to recede. It's quite likely to grow. And as we said at the beginning of the conversation, part of what Trump has done is to shock the Europeans into realizing that they may be on their own and NATO may not in fact be any longer the comfort blanket that it's been since the late 1940s.
Mm. You mentioned the article you recently wrote about U.S. debt, and we spoke about Ferguson's Law. How concerned are you about the debt at this point?
Oh, this is the big problem, because the United States should not be running a 6% of GDP deficit at full employment, which it was last year, and it should not be spending more on interest payments than on its defense budget, which it really has only very rarely done in the past and for very brief periods. If it carries on like this, it'll be spending twice as much on interest payments as on defense by the 2040s. So the problem is how you fix that. If the economy slows, if it really slows, then the deficit likely widens. I don't know how Scott Bessent gets it to 3%, which is his target.
Mm.
That will be a tremendous feat if he can achieve it. If you don't do that, if you don't stabilize the debt deficit at somewhere like 3% of GDP, then the trajectory of the debt is dauntingly, dauntingly steep. And remember, a lot of foreign owners, this is not a domestically held debt. There is a substantial foreign ownership. The bond market has been tamed by central banks to a large extent in our time. That was part of what lay behind quantitative easing. But it's not clear to me that the Fed will be able to prevent a kind of bond market spasm if it appears to foreign holders of bonds that the U.S. is no longer the preeminent superpower. So if you had a crisis over Taiwan and the U.S. folded, and Taiwan ended up following Hong Kong into Beijing's tender embrace, then I think there would be a serious problem. So this is a huge vulnerability. And although I have been writing and talking about this for a quarter of a century, it has only got worse in that time.
Mm. Okay, final question. What, if anything, could happen in this Trump term that would convince you or even convince some diehard supporters of the current administration that Trump 2.0 was a terrible mistake? I mean, what foreseeable thing could he do, or what outcome could follow from some of the issues we've raised here, where the onus would be on him and the choices he's made? I guess you could add Elon there. What would force a radical reconsideration of the current moment on the part of people who are currently happy with the direction things are going?
I'll try to rank these roughly. I think an abandonment of Taiwan to the People's Republic of China would be a pretty major sign that this was a mistake, because that would lead to a cascade of consequences, as it would signal the end of American primacy. Secondly, a partition of Ukraine that is just the prelude to its absorption, entire absorption by Russia. That would be a second. A third would be if the courts wholly fail to withstand the effort to recreate the imperial presidency to the point that Nixon got it in 72. I mean, I think there are going to be some major battles, but if the courts basically yield on all the issues, I don't worry so much about impoundment, but if you end up in a situation where the executive branch is able to count on the Supreme Court on every issue, that would be quite troubling. And the fourth thing, which might surprise you, I think the fourth thing that would make me feel that we've gone down a dark alley would be if political violence became reestablished as an integral part of our political culture.
Mm.
And that would not be a direct consequence of Trump's re-election. It would be a part of that decline of Republican stability that I was talking about earlier. Can I give you the things that would convince me it's not been a mistake?
Yeah, please.
Because we should consider those too. I think it will be a sign that my worries were exaggerated if Ukraine emerges as the South Korea of Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
as an integral part of the European Union and its defense strategy, and that Russia is unable to crush the 80% of Ukraine that is still free. I'll have my spirits considerably raised if the Chinese never really make a move against Taiwan and Taiwan continues to be a flourishing Chinese democracy. Thirdly, I will be pleasantly cheered up if the Trump administration suffers some legal setbacks, especially if a couple of them are at the SCOTUS level. And finally, if we all live happily ever after, and there's a diminution of, not an increase of violence, and maybe this is too much to hope for, Sam, but if the effect of re-electing Donald Trump is to put an end to the insanity that has characterized American higher education over mm-hmm. the last 10 years and restore liberalism to academia, then it will all have been worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, if we get that your final list plus an end to wokeness on campus, you can count me happy as well. So let's
we've got to consider these two scenarios. I said
I'll have you back,
the historian
whatever
happens, of the present.
Yeah.
We don't know as historians of the present how this story turns out any more than we'll know the outcome of a close soccer game. That's what makes history more like sport than literature. We just don't know the ending. And so whether it's a tragedy or a comedy or some other genre, it remains to be seen. But one has to somehow keep one's mind open and consider the different paths. Always remember, there are multiple histories of the future. We don't really know which one we're going to get. And it's certainly too early to say with absolute certainty, as some people love to do, this is a complete disaster. Fascism has arrived in the United States. I mean, that whole narrative was wrong the first time. I mean, the same people are saying it who said it in 2016, 17. It was wrong then. But it might be right this time. It might finally be Sinclair Lewis. Maybe it is finally happening here. I can't completely rule that out. But I wish the people who said it with such certainty would be open to the possibility that they're wrong and it isn't going to turn out to be, it can't happen here.
Well, one of the things you said last time we spoke, I think it was the last time you spoke, you asked me to entertain the counterfactual of Clinton having won in 2016 and what that would have meant for how the far right or the, you know, everyone right of center would have behaved having, you know, not gotten what they wanted. And that was a, you know, instructive at the time and instructs me in the present because, currently the one thing the right cannot say is that they didn't get what they wanted.
Right.
Now they can, you know, whatever happens in these next 2 years, certainly it is Trump and Trumpism and the Republican Party in the driver's seat, and they will own what happens next.
The other counterfactual is, what if the bullet had killed him? What if the bullet had killed him? What
I think we can agree that would have been a, if you wanted a reduction in political violence, that was not the way to get it.
So, that was a great turning point not to take.
Yeah, No doubt.
Maybe on that semi-optimistic note, we can draw this excellent conversation to a conclusion.
Yeah, yeah. As always, it's great to talk to you, Neil. Until next time.
It's a pleasure, Sam. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And yeah, I look forward to the next time. We'll see. Perhaps we'll know next time we speak which path the U.S. is actually on. I still don't know.
Yeah. Well, the door is always open here. So when you have something you want to talk about, just give me a ring and we'll do it again.
Appreciate it.